Hey, friends, and welcome. This is the Happy Warrior Podcast. In today's Hardy episode, we will be deep diving into the hard issues facing the country. We will first be going into what is happening in the world of U.S. politics. Yes, we will be discussing the vice presidential debate between Harris and VP Mike Pence, why that debate matters, and that will lead us into the discussion of the Democrats being led by Joe Biden pushing for court packing and why that is such a disastrous, dangerous decision. Both electorally and for the sanctity of the republic and our democracy. And then finally, continuing our series of heavy issues facing the country in the big picture, our big October surprises, if you will, we will be discussing the issue of big tech and Silicon Valley and how plan to influence the election and the future of the country. And for a fun bonus, we will be including an introduction to my new big research piece for the post-millennial. We got a lot to talk about today, so get comfy, put on your seatbelts, and let's have ourselves a podcast.
The Happy Warrior Podcast. Conservative commentary on the news of the day from a more positive perspective.
Man, oh man, what a crazy week it's been for me, and it is great to be here back at the microphone with all of you. I hope all of you are holding in there and doing well. The last episode of the podcast really did very well, and I thank all of you for your listenership and your support. Thank you so much for checking in the podcast and sharing with your friends. We have some good iTunes reviews. All that is excellent, so thank you. This week, I had some exciting news come out, and my big research project for the post-millennial got published. It's called Electronic Arts Teams Up with the ADL to Enforce Social Justice in Gaming. This project took a ton of work, and I'm really grateful it came out. We will be talking about that later here in today's episode of the podcast. But before we do, I want to talk about what is going on with politics here in the United States. We are kind of facing more of the endless October surprise. It used to be with October surprises, you kind of would just have a one and done. Something crazy would happen and would shift the whole momentum of the race. But now it seems like we are getting things that might be considered traditionally October surprise two or three times a week. It has been an incredibly eventful October in the world of U.S. presidential politics. Fortunately, last week's surprise that President Trump had came down with COVID, well, the man is doing much better, and it seems like he got through that health trial, okay, and we here at the podcast are grateful he's going to be okay. Never a good thing to see a major public figure be sick. Never a good thing to see anyone to be sick, to be honest. So I'm grateful he's doing so much better, and we aren't going to lose him to this terrible virus. Well, for this week's surprise, what might change the momentum in the presidential race? We have the vice presidential debate, which actually typically is not very important. But as I show you here in this episode, it actually this time, the debate between Kamala Harris and Mike Pence actually is pretty substantial. It'll have some big impact not only on this race, but going on in the future, which I know isn't conventional wisdom, but let me make my case to you. Now, traditionally, vice presidential debates don't mean diddly bubkiss. Normally, not that many viewers tune in to a VP debate. What happens there doesn't change a lot of minds. If you consider that the people who will be tuning in to a vice presidential debate to watch it, particularly on a Wednesday night, the majority of them will be decided voters. So you can get a lot of undecideds on a presidential debate normally. But at a VP debate, it's more people who are really into politics. Now, that doesn't mean there is no value to a vice presidential debate. Depending on how candidates do in a vice presidential debate, it can determine their political futures. You know, if Kamala was to lose this or Pence was to lose this, the next time it's the presidential round, they would largely be considered the most likely to step in as the new party's nominee. And polls show this. Mike Pence is sitting at, back in December, he has a 40% likelihood of being the next GOP presidential nominee if or not Trump loses. And that puts him far ahead of other people who are often put out there like Josh Hawley. Vice presidential debates can also have another very important impact, is that they can change the dynamics of the race depending on what issues are raised and seem to get attention. which is exactly what happened at the VP debate. And that particular issue ended up being court packing. So what exactly happened Wednesday night? Well, all in all, Wednesday night was a very good night for Mike Pence and somewhat for the Trump campaign. As you probably remember from the week previously, and as we talked about it on the podcast here, the first presidential debate between Donald Trump and Joe Biden ended up being just a complete, utter mess. Both candidates got on some good points. Trump made some solid hits on Biden, but because everyone was in each other's face and they were constantly interrupting each other, it just came out as a night that looked very bad for both of them. And as I said, because the media will always carry the Democrats' water, the message that came out of it was, this is on Donald Trump. The polls reflect this. Voter surveys reflect this. All in all, voters more than not blamed the president for that just terrible debacle of a mess. And most people felt it was just entirely embarrassing. This, of course, did not help the president's poll numbers very well. And then the president got COVID. And so they really needed a positive night to see if they could stem the damage that was being done from all that kerfuffle. So Wednesday night, you can imagine that it was very important that Mike Pence got in there and struck home run after home run. First example is Pence talking about the Russiagate situation. It's a great, strong statement from him.
Stronger in the last 4 years. But when you talk about accepting the outcome of the election, I must tell you, Senator, your party has spent the last 3.5 years trying to overturn the results of the last election. It's amazing. When Joe Biden was vice president of the United States, the FBI actually spied on President Trump and my campaign. I mean, there were documents released this week that the CIA actually made a referral to the FBI documenting that those allegations were coming from the Hillary Clinton campaign. And of course, we've all seen the avalanche, what you put the country through for the better part of 3 years until it was found that there was no obstruction, no collusion, case closed. And then Senator Harris, you and your colleagues in the Congress tried to impeach the president of the United States over a phone call. And now Hillary Clinton has actually said to Joe Biden that under no circumstances should he concede the election. So let me just say, I think we're going to win this election. President Trump and I are fighting.
Second example is when Pence responds to Kamala Harris setting up that the Trump administration is bad when it comes to stuff on race, and inevitably gets the discussion of the riots, and Pence, he just deflects the attack so deftly. This is very well handled. Listen here.
Is a great insult to the men and women who serve in law enforcement, and I want everyone to know who puts on the uniform of law enforcement every day, that President Trump and I stand with you. And it is remarkable that when Senator Tim Scott tried to pass a police reform bill, brought together a group of Republicans and Democrats, Senator Harris, you got up and walked out of the room. And then you filibustered Senator Tim Scott's bill on the Senate floor that would have provided new accountability, new resources. But we don't have to choose between supporting law enforcement, improving public safety, and supporting our African-American neighbors and all of our minorities. Under President Trump's leadership, we will always stand with law enforcement and we'll do what we've done from day one, and
that
is improve the lives of African-Americans.
Thank you, Vice President
Pence. Record unemployment, record investments in education, and we'll fight for school choice for all of our minorities.
Thank you, Vice President.
As you can tell, Mike Pence was on top of his game Wednesday night. He was well prepared. You can tell that he took the debate prep very seriously. He studied the files. He knew all the comebacks and where to attack. He was in cool control. He knew when to interrupt, when to ignore the moderator. He knew when to deflect questions. He knew when to answer the premise of the moderator and Kamala Harris and when to ignore it. He was top of his game. If I had to give a score to Mike Pence on Wednesday night, I would give him an A-. I mean, it was just extraordinary. It was such a phenomenal performance of how a Republican candidate should behave themselves. Now, look, I give him an A-, because Mike Pence he's Mike Pence, man. I can relate to this guy on this level. He is generic, white bread, vanilla, milk toast Republican all the way. And you know what? I love it. I love it. I know many people love that and miss it. It's not very exciting. You don't get a lot of easy social media hits from it. And of course, the media are not going to help Pence or the Trump campaign get these great moments out, as we'll get into what is the conventional wisdom of this debate. But man, oh man, Mike Pence really impressed me. He really impressed me. Now, I just, you know, it felt with the Trump campaign, there have been these moments where you're like, where are the adults? Where are the people who are taking this seriously, buckling down, really, you know, getting hard-nosed and giving it their all? And you often feel like, whether it's the president or it's his campaign people, whatever, you feel like people just are not giving their A game. Even more so than 2016, I felt that the Trump campaign was really strong in 2016. They ran a really great campaign. He made big mistakes, but he made up for them. He more than made up for him. And this time around, it feels like the Trump campaign, not so much. He's a bit too loose on Twitter. They let the language get out of hand. They don't handle the media as well. And their debates, they just aren't as well prepared for. Now, this kind of thing isn't too uncommon with incumbent presidents. But as we'll get into later in this episode, that combined with the huge deficits that have been created by big tech and the media, that may be enough for a Biden win. And I don't say that. I don't want Biden to win. I'm not a Trump fan, but I'm very disconcerned with what a Biden administration might bring in with it. But I got to be honest with you guys. When they're not doing well, I'm not going to tell you. But when they do well, and they did on Wednesday night with VP Mike Pence, I'll praise it. I'll clap for it. I'll tell you it was awesome, because it was. It was so good. It was just so well handled. The Trump campaign should have given big high fives all night. Mike Pence, I mean, give him a slap on the butt. That was fantastic work by the VP. Just very impressive. I have one more critical moment I want to show you guys, but before we get to it, you need to know. So what was the conventional wisdom? What did the media take away from the night? Well, you could tell that Mike Pence won this thing because the media came away with two narratives. Number one, Mike Pence is a bit of a weirdo, and he has this moment where he has a fly on his head. In fact, that segment two audio I shared with you is part of that, and he has this fly that's just sitting on his head for a good 2 or 3 minutes, and the media just made big hay of this. It was pretty funny, I have to admit. But you could kind of tell that Mike Pence did really well because no one was willing to say Mike Pence did really well. Instead, they focused on how mean Mike Pence was in the fly. And so the fly was the first one. The second one was mansplaining. And I said this on Twitter before the debate was over. I said, this is what the media is going to go with. They are going to say that Mike Pence is part of the patriarchy and he was mansplaining at the debate. And here are some clips of that narrative as it came out live.
That to you, because obviously Mike Pence is a former television commentator, does have a very calm demeanor, but I think a lot of people were noticing some mansplaining going on tonight.
When she was being interrupted, Senator Harris did not look at the vice president and say, "Don't interrupt me." What did she say? "I'm speaking now." I think that is an important stylistic difference. She's not giving the vice president an order, "Stop interrupting me." She is asserting, "I'm speaking now." And I think many American women heard that and said, "I know what that feels like."
I wonder if a woman candidate feels like she can't push as much or steamroll as much as, say, Mike Pence can, for fear of seeming and offending some segment of the electorate. I'm not saying it should be that way, but I'm wondering if it is that way.
Well, I'll tell you this, and Abby, I want to get your thoughts on this. I was texting with a friend who is an African-American man saying, do you think that she's kind of letting some things go in a way that maybe she shouldn't? And the answer was, are you kidding me? You know that she's a Black woman. She has to kind of pull her punches on that.
Those clips were first from George Stephanopoulos at ABC, then it went to CBS, then it went to CNN. You get the general idea. The big narrative that came out of that night wasn't that Kamala Harris did badly. No, it was that Mike Pence is a patriarchal, racist, interrupting jerk. Now, does that reflect reality? If you look at the stats from the debate, when you look at time given for speaking and amount of interruptions, both show that neither is true. The official speaking time from that night was Mike Pence spoke 35 minutes, 22 seconds. Harris, she spoke for 38 minutes, 48 seconds. So the idea that Mike Pence took over the time and spoke more than Kamala Harris that night is just not true. When you look at stats of attacks made during the debate and interruptions, this is from 538, not a conservative outlet in the least. They said that Harris made 84 attacks that night, Pence made 93, Harris gave 9 interruptions, and Pence gave 16. Now, Pence does have more interruptions, but it's not a significant number above that. They both were giving hard attacks and many interruptions. By the way, as they should, both of these candidates acted pretty professional as debates go, especially more professional than the Biden-Trump debate from the week previously. But because Harris did so badly, what the media ran with was Mike Pence was just an obnoxious, patriarchal jerk who just kept getting in the way and making her feel unsafe. As for polling to show how Americans felt about the debate, we really do not have a lot of evidence about which way they go. But they don't tend to do tons of polls on this. The kind of polls you will get are very few scientific polls, and mostly it will be on Twitter or on your local news site. Tell us what you think of how they did. And so, you know, Drudge puts out a thing. Well, of course, they're going to get a large majority of people saying the conservative candidate, the Republican candidate, won it. And you'll see the same kind of version thing on the left. So we don't really have a great idea about who won. Morning Consult political poll, they said they felt overall that Kamala Harris performed best, but it was pretty close. It was 43 to 37, so not a huge margin over Pence. There's also a CNN poll, but that one only used 609 registered voters, and I'm not totally sure if looking at the survey itself, this poll was completely legit, so we're not going to even look at that one. A 538 poll asked about 1,725 adults, and they found that Kamala Harris came out stronger than Mike Pence. So, I mean, there are two scientific polls that have a good chance of being legitimate. An interesting poll that came out, this was, they talked about it here on Axios, it's from Axios and SurveyMonkey, found that actually, overall, most people that watched the debate, and there were about 50 million of them, were pretty happy with the debate. They felt that it was much more professional, that fewer people said they came away angry. Only 15% of Republicans, 9% of Democrats said they walked away angry. 36% of those that respond say they felt relieved when the debate was over. People used words like, this debate is civil, informative, and presidential. One more thing I'd like to add to the reactions from professional pollsters. Frank Luntz, who used to be with Fox News but now is with the LA Times, had a group of undecided voters, and he polls them through different scientific means. One of them is he hands them these dials, and they turn it depending how they feel of the reaction happening in debate at any moment. Anyhow, he interviews these people after the debate, and he said that his undecided focus group overall did not care for how Kamala Harris interacted with her opponent. He said, we saw this in the Dem debate. She's applauded for her knowledge, but they just don't like her condescending reactions. They felt that Kamala was condescending. They said that Mike Pence, according to them, was more professional, but he looks overall tired. They think Harris is more passionate, but her reaction faces, she did this over and over again. When she gets in a bind, she gets very bobbly, and she sneers and smirks, and she laughs. And sometimes it helps because the laugh sometimes is able to pull her out of bad situations, but if it doesn't work, it comes off very grumpy to people who are watching it at home. The reactions on Twitter, of course, aren't any way to measure this, but all my Republican friends, all my conservative friends, many people who are alt or who are, you know, libertarian, whatever, non-traditional heterodox thinking people, they loved Mike Pence. They thought he did fantastic. People who are, you know, big GOP politicos were very, very excited and happy with what happened that night. So at least from the side, if you are a Republican viewer, you are very happy with that night with Mike Pence. Now, people on the left, of course, they seem very happy with Kamala Harris. So who knows if any of this means anything. But it was a good night for Mike Pence. It really was. And for a campaign that really needs some thunder and some juice in it to get their base excited again, this was a great night to help the Trump campaign with Frank Luntz, with the pretty close reaction data, even from CNN. It was a good night for Pence. It was a good night for the Trump campaign. I'll be perfectly honest with you guys, because I trust you, my audience, that you can handle hard truth, even if it's inconvenient for your side. The Biden campaign is doing very well right now, and the Trump campaign is doing very poorly. National polls in particular are really bad. We are seeing things like 18 or 16 plus for Biden. Now, I don't trust the national. National doesn't actually mean very much, but even saying you get rid of the bias, and it's still a 6% lead for Biden, that I think would be a fair thing to guess. I have a friend that kind of did the math on this. That's still way ahead, and that would be very bad for Trump in November. But we are looking at the battleground states, and with the exception of Arizona, Biden is basically ahead in every single one of them. And he's ahead in some of these by 4 or 5 digits. So this is a very bad situation for the Trump campaign. Many people are asking if there's any way for the Trump campaign to be able to flip this thing and change the momentum and get back on top of the polls. And again, I caution you, my friends who are Republicans, who are Trump supporters, it is easy to just say all the polls are bullcrap. They're all wrong. They were wrong in 2016. They are all wrong now. But the polls right now are just, they're such a huge margin in the Biden lead currently that even putting in that the polls are wrong, it still looks very likely that Biden has a strong ahead. There are some things that maybe you think in the certain battleground states, Trump is doing better. We've talked about Hispanic and Latino support in Florida. You look at Republican registrations in Pennsylvania over the last year. There are things that say maybe the polls don't have the full story, but it's really difficult. It's very difficult, even with all the errors in the polling, to say that Trump is secretly doing well. So I know people want to go the other direction. Part of me wishes we could, but I'm an honest journalist, so I'm going to be honest with you, my good audience. As hard as that may be for some of you, for those of us who are worried about Biden winning, or for those of you who want Trump to win. One last thing on the debates that you need to know, and this moves into our next segment. There was a moment that Pence really pinned down Kamala Harris in a way that was flabbergasting. He got her into a place where she could not give a straight answer. She came up with this ahistorical BS. I don't know where she heard it, but it was just so wrong. And she could never give a complete answer. And it was on the issue of court packing. Joe Biden had before this not given a clear answer to the issue of court packing. He said, if I talk about this, then this will become the issue, which is so crazy. You can't say that. You can't say that. I mean, the media was willing to carry water for him then. For the most part, they have. But this is an important moment in this debate because that changes it in a substantial way. So Pence brings this up, and Kamala Harris does not have an answer. She does not have an answer, and this is by far the most important moment of the Wednesday debate. It may be the moment that changes everything, at least for the Republicans in the Senate. So you guys need to take a listen to this.
For our part, I would never presume how Judge Amy Coney Barrett would rule on the Supreme Court of the United States, but we'll continue to stand strong for the right to life. When you speak about the Supreme Court, though, I think the American people really deserve an answer, Senator Harris. Are you and Joe Biden going to pack the court if Judge Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed? I mean, there have been 29 vacancies on the Supreme Court during presidential election years, from George Washington to Barack Obama. Presidents have nominated in all 29 cases. But your party is actually openly advocating adding seats to the Supreme Court, which has had 9 seats for 150 years, if you don't get your way. This is a classic case of if you can't win by the rules, you're going to change the rules. Now, you've refused to answer the question. Joe Biden has refused to answer the question. So I think the American people would really like to know, if Judge Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed to the Supreme Court of the United States, are you and Joe Biden, if somehow you win this election, going to pack the Supreme Court to get your way?
I'm so glad we went through a little history lesson. Let's do that a little more. In 1864...
Well, I'd like you to answer the question.
No, Mr. Yes, Vice President, I'm speaking. Okay. In 1864, one of the, I think, political heroes, certainly of the president, I assume of you also, Mr. Vice President, is Abraham Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
Abraham Lincoln was up for re-election, and it was 27 days before the election, and a seat became open on the United States Supreme Court. Abraham Lincoln's party was in charge not only of the White House, but the Senate. But Honest Abe said, it's not the right thing to do. The American people deserve to make the decision about who will be the next president of the United States, and then that person can select who will serve for a lifetime on the highest court of our land. And so Joe and I are very clear. The American people are voting right now, and it should be their decision about who will serve on this most important body for a lifetime.
Thank you, Senator Harris.
People, Susan, are voting right now. They'd like to know if you and Joe Biden are going to pack the Supreme Court if you don't get your way in this nomination.
Let's talk about packing.
You once again gave a non-answer. Joe Biden gave a non-answer.
Trying to answer you now.
The American people deserve a straight answer. And if you haven't figured it out yet, the straight answer is they are going to pack the Supreme Court if they somehow win this election.
Welcome back. Let's talk about why court packing is such a fundamentally dangerous idea. It is hard to put into words, but it is one of these kind of ideas that you worry that could become the spark for something more. But before we go there, please, if you are not subscribed yet to the podcast, please do so, and please share this on your social media. Sharing us by word of mouth and on your social media makes such a huge difference. Give us an iTunes review if you haven't done already. A nice 5-star review with nice plump why you love the Happy Warrior podcast would be very helpful. If you want to follow us on social media, we're at Happy Warrior P on Twitter and at Happy Warrior Pete for Facebook and Minds. You're welcome to contact us there. Check us our social media. Let us know what you think of the podcast and other journalism stuff that we do. So as we left off, I played you that clip of Kamala Harris not being able to answer Mike Pence. When he asks Kamala, so are you and Joe Biden going to stack the Supreme Court? And she can't give an answer. She then gave this ridiculous, ahistorical answer about Abraham Lincoln, how he loved the idea of refusing to push someone through the Supreme Court, how he would be just okay with the idea of stacking the Supreme Court. I mean, it was such a gobbledygook. There's nothing to back this up. The closest you could get it, and Dan McLaughlin, who's a journalist for the National Review and a Lincoln historian, he strongly pointed out in now a very big viral post that this was just complete garbage. And in fact, the case she is referring to, Lincoln did push to fill the Supreme Court vacancy at his first possible chance back in 1864 into 1865. Well, her non-answer did get picked up by some in the media. Even the reporter Jake Tapper on CNN, who was part of this discussion with Dana Bash about how Mike Pence was a mansplainer, he even said that when Kamala Harris didn't answer questions about packing the Supreme Court, he said, quote, that is significant, and Biden and Harris should have to answer for it, unquote. This moment from the debate did not just stay at the debate. It found legs. There had already been the question about Joe Biden not giving a clear answer when he is asked, will you support court packing when the election is over? And he would routinely say things like, I will not give an answer now because if I did, that would become what the discussion is about. Well, after the debate, some reporters did go to Biden and they asked him this question again. Take a listen.
Gotta stop. They'll know my opinion of court packing when the election is over. Now, look, I know it's a great question, y'all, and I don't blame you for asking. But you know, the moment I answer that question, the headline in every one of your papers will be about that. Other than focusing on what's happening now. The election has begun. There's never been a court appointment once an election begun.
That answer, by the way, is completely unacceptable, and it should not have been allowed to have so much oxygen like it did for the mainstream media, who would not make him fess up to the question. That ridiculous statement is exactly the kind of attitude we saw with Nancy Pelosi when it came to the issue of the ACA bill. And people are asking, what's in this thing? And she said, remember this famous moment.
But we have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it.
This statement to people is just really gross. And so those that heard it started to cause ears to perk up. Even the media, who were willing to carry the water for the Democrats, I mean, carry it like you've never seen the media carry water for the left ever before. It's incredible this election season this year. But when you have Joe Biden, when he goes on record 4 or 5 times in a row in the span of about 2 weeks, and he makes this statement, even the mainstream media can no longer keep this thing quiet. So thus, over this weekend, Joe Biden moved to a crazy place that has only made this situation for the Democrats even worse, and may have put new air in the Republican Senate campaigns. Just yesterday, here is Joe Biden when the reporter goes to him once again, are you going to support packing the court? Biden exclaims that actually it's the Republicans who are being unconstitutional.
The only court packing is going on right now. It's going on with Republicans packing the court now. It's not constitutional what they're doing. We should be focused on what's happening right now. And the fact is that the only packing going on is this court is being packed now by the Republicans after the vote has already begun. I'm going to stay focused on it so we don't take our eyes off the ball here.
So there you have it. Under pressure that perhaps the Republicans might be right, that court packing is a very, very bad idea. The Democrats, led by Biden, and much of the media, have got a new memo, and that is Republicans are the ones that are burning the constitutional order because they've been doing the real court packing all along, and it's unconstitutional, don't you know? As the Daily Wire reports, Biden Dems accused GOP of court packing for filling vacancies, confirming conservative judges. This moment after Biden gives this thing, it's amazing how Biden gives this statement, and then all these left-wing organizations with much money in the bank, and people in the mainstream media, people at the New York Times, they all come out with the same stuff, with the same narrative. It's incredible. It's almost as if they knew Biden was going to say something like this. Now, that just wouldn't be possible, right? Anyhow, examples of this, Sam Berger, the vice president of the far-left Center for American Progress, is pushing this hard, especially on Twitter, and calling it conservative court packing. He has this lovely, colorful chart with it. And he writes, conservative stealth court packing plan, step one. Steal seats by blocking confirmation of judges until White House and Senate are under conservative control. Step two, change the rules to appoint the most partisan conservative judges at breakneck speed. Dan Rather says that this is court packing. Can we recognize that at all levels of the judiciary has been the Republican playbook for decades? Ask for Merrick Garland. The new narrative being pushed by the left is that really, when Republicans, when they had control of the presidency and the Senate, and for a time, the House as well, and they were putting judges on the court, that wasn't obeying the Constitution and the rules we'd all agreed to as a society and under the constitutional order. Instead, that was, in plain sight, slow-motion court packing. Da, da, da! So, this is so apparent that this is just bollocks, what is now being pushed in the media and by the Democrats, that the Republicans are doing the ones that is unconstitutional. That even Jake Tapper on CNN, he is talking with the Biden campaign spokesperson, and he goes to her and he says,
how is it not but he said it's not constitutional what they're doing. How is it not constitutional what they're doing?
His point is that the people have an opportunity to weigh in on this constitutional process through their vote. And we are now in the midst of the election. Millions of people have already cast their votes. And you see that the vast majority of people say that they want the person who wins the election on November 3rd to nominate the justice.
That's a poll. That's not the Constitution.
So there's the constitutional process of advising consent. The American people get to have their say by voting for president, by voting for senators. We are now 23 days from the election.
Right, but it's not unconstitutional.
Millions of votes. Voters are being denied their constitutional right to have a say in this process.
They elected the Senate.
Are trying to ram through. A nominee who, by the way, is going to change the makeup of the court. And we see time and time again, poll after poll shows that most Americans vehemently disagree with this.
Kate, that's a poll.
The vote should happen on November 3rd.
That's not what the word constitutional means.
Constitutional doesn't
mean I like it or I don't like it. It means it's according to the U.S. Constitution. There's nothing unconstitutional about what the U.S. Senate is doing.
All right, Jake Tapper, you get applause for that, man. Well done. Well done. Thank you. Man, I love it. I just love it. Sometimes when you have brisk showers of journalism at places like CNN, it is just wonderful. It is an indescribable kind of feeling. I love it. Thank you, Jake Tapper, for doing your job. And that should really tell you something, folks. If Jake Tapper is even pointing out that this is Bubkiss, that's constitutional. You're that's not what constitutional means. And what do you do for that? What do you do? This is so obvious that this is just complete and utter bubkiss. This is bollocks. This is zilch. This is flimflam. I can't think of any more synonyms right now. But you have to agree, this is hot garbage. I mean, even the Atlantic. The Atlantic is saying that Biden and Harris need to give an answer on court packing now. This is why I said in the previous segment that the VP debate may have mattered more than a VP debate should, because they got the pressure going on this issue of court packing. Now, does Joe Biden himself, does he want court packing? It's hard to tell. Joe Biden back in 2005 said it was a bad idea. He said FDR had fallen to the temptation of absolute power. That's 2005 Joe Biden. One would hope he still holds that view. But his running mate, the lady he chose to be on his ticket, Kamala Harris, said and laughed in his face that court packing needed to happen. And he responded that if Democrats did that, they would rue the day. And the polls that have come out that have looked at this over the weekend are just devastating on the issue. People said in a poll that while in general Americans are against the idea of Trump pushing forward a Supreme Court nominee right now, a vast majority, 68% of respondents, said they were against court packing. This included, by the way, a majority of Democrats and independents. Americans, their civil education is probably at the worst place it's been in over a century. We do not seem to care very much, that most of us, the normies, about what is happening in Washington, D.C. They don't really know really what's going on most of the time. They don't have a good grasp of the issues. So the culture's power is very forceful and effective. But we still have this ember. We still have this memory from our great-grandparents who, in the Depression, when FDR tried to push forward court packing, that there was a huge upheaval against it. Americans still have a hatred for this. They still fear court packing. They do. The real kind. Not just appointing someone when you control both the Senate and the White House, but changing the name of the game. Changing the 159-year precedent. That is more than half of the length of this country. It's so established. It's such a part of our norms. Okay, it's pre-Civil War that we said we will only have 9 justices on the Supreme Court. 9, that's it. There is no desire among Americans, except for some extreme people on the left-wing part of the Democrat Party, that want this and think this is a good idea. And this should give you hope, my friends. For those of us that are worried that perhaps America's best days are behind us, at least for our civil order and for the Constitution, this should give you hope, because it shows that Americans may very well be against the social justice onslaught to overturn all of the constitutional order and replace it with quick fixes so that the progressives stay in charge, perhaps forever. And it seems to me that Americans are kind of getting a feel for this idea of being a little bit outrageous, and it probably will not be enough to save it for Trump. If Trump needs saving, this will not be what saves him, most likely. But it might be able to save is the Republican Senate races. I have here an article from John Fund. Democrats' silence of court packing could cost them Senate control. And John points out that there are a bunch of Democrats that are running for Senate. Places like Maine, Colorado, Iowa, Michigan, elsewhere, where the races are decently close, but these Democrat candidates aren't able to give a clear answer on this, and it's hurting them. And it might be enough to save these Senate seats and perhaps save Senate control for the Republicans come November, whatever happens to Trump. He uses examples like in Alabama, Doug Jones is doing very poorly against his opponent. In Michigan, Gary Peters is only up by 3%. That's a seat that a Republican might be able to take. But, you know, even in Minnesota, where Republicans have a long shot of winning, the Democrat senator there only leads by 8 points by the average of polls there. And there are that's just a handful of them. But there are several races where it looks like this might be enough to tank it for the Democrats and give the Republicans a real shot of holding on to the Senate. So it may very well be that the vice presidential debate put enough pressure to get this issue out there that it could hurt the Democrats in a big way if they do not get a clear answer on it. So that VP debate, it might end up being a big October surprise. Not a huge one, but a decent enough sized one that it could be enough to save the Republicans the Senate. Now, I have no idea if that's true. But the reason why it will be able to do that is because this represents an issue that we are seeing with the hard left in a very worrying way that does give me anxiety about the state of the country and the future. And if you study up the issue, it will probably will do that for you too. I turn to one of the greatest writers I know who put it very clearly. Just today on this issue. Kevin Williamson article, a National Review. The question Biden won't answer. The Democratic case for packing the courts is made most recently by people at the New York Times as a kind of confession. The left understands the Supreme Court as a genie that exists to grant Democratic wishes. Poof, abortion. Shazam, gay marriage. It is far more convenient to enjoy one-stop utopianism imposed by the Supreme Court than to have 50 different fights in the state legislators in Topeka, Lansing, Boise, etc. The left consequently understands that a court constrained by textualism, the radical belief that we write down our laws for a reason rather than just asking what the New York Times prefers, would be a hindrance to its political agenda, which includes serial violations of the Bill of Rights on matters ranging from free speech to religion to the right to keep and bear arms. He jokes, one half expects Elizabeth Warren and Jacob Frey to pop up like pests in some political version of whack-a-mole and make the case for the forced quartering of federal troops. That is one of the things that must be plainly understood about the question that Joe Biden refuses to answer. The assault on the Supreme Court is only a proxy battle for an assault on the Bill of Rights. Kevin Williamson, wonderful thinker and journalist, 110% right. That is what the push for the Supreme Court is. It is an attack on the Bill of Rights and the constitutional order. It is an attack on the very idea of the United States of America and how it operates. We work in a constitutional, democratic, republic, all those three parts, the democracy, the Republic of the Constitution are fundamental pillars for how our country functions and why it is such a raging success. You need all those parts, okay? We need to have the freedom to choose, to vote, to organize. That's the democracy. But we also have to have certain questions that are beyond the mob. That's the Bill of Rights. You have freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom to bear arms, freedom to defend your home and own property, freedom to have your day in court. There are things that are too important to let democracies get a hold of. That's another pillar. The third pillar is the constitutional order that protects all this. There are certain rules that this country goes by. We do elections in a certain way. We have certain rules that protects us and protect keeps these three pillars up and is what our country is built upon. The Democrats, led by Joe Biden, and the radical Democrats, and I don't know if it's Joe Biden specifically, but he's allowing this to happen. So you can only put the blame on him. Whether this is what he wants is heart of hearts. Is an attack on all three pillars, essentially, is an attack on the country. And that is not hyperbole. They are trying to undo the very essence of the United States of America. They no longer want the pillar that says certain questions can't be touched by the mob. We don't like guns. We're tired of that. We are tired of freedom of speech. It's getting in the way of our hate speech laws. We're tired of these laws against segregation. California is now purging this rule of law against segregation from its state constitution right now. These are things that we have said. These are beyond majorities. These are beyond the whims of the people. There are things that are so fundamental, God-given, you can't touch it. You can't touch it because they're too sacred. They're too important. They're part of being a human being with a divine soul and a mind to think. And the Democrats say, no, actually, we want to get a hold of those and we want to change them. We want to destroy them. And this is shocking, but that's what all this is. Kevin Williamson, he jumps back and he says, the court packing scheme is part of a series of profit shenanigans by which the Democrat Party means to establish long-term single-party rule in the United States. This is why they want to change D.C. or Puerto Rico into a state, as some are demanding, because this would create new Senate seats that would be entirely or almost entirely Democratic. Abolishing the Electoral College would usurp the role of the states in political elections is of interest to Democrats only because they believe that they would win more elections under a national electoral system than under the federal system. We are seeing similar shenanigans conducted in places like California with the open primary system, which they said was for a progressive advance for democracy, but is simply really a way to keep Republican candidates off the general election ballots. All these shenanigans, Kevin Williamson writes, are part of a broader project to entrench Democratic power and stamp out all dissent, an effort that includes the weaponization of the IRS and the ATF, as we saw in the Obama years. The cynical abuse of the NLRB, the perversion of prosecutorial powers as politicized weapons in political vendettas, carried out by people like Kamala Harris and Democratic prosecutors in New York, as we saw, for example, against the NRA in New York, or against all those that had broke the marijuana laws in California, which Harris was ruthless about. So if you're a drug warrior, you're against the drug warriors, Harris is just a terrible pick. I mean, she does frighten me. Her stance as a prosecutor is just frightening. Back to the article. Democratic attempts to legally abolish activist groups, bully banks, and insurance companies, to denying them ordinary financial services, the weaponization of employment and access to college education as instruments of political coercion, the misuse of national security powers to target a Republican presidential campaign, and now the systemic campaign of riots and arson leading up to the 2020 election. That is what, and this is why, this election, my anxiety, man, is just through the roof sometimes when I think about it. And I don't like Trump. I really do not like the man. The things he said about my religion, the things that he has done to people like myself who are disabled and have chronic pain, you know, the opioid prohibition. I think he's been very uncouth. I think he's been awful, and sometimes I try, sometimes he's been great, but other times not so much. I have big problems with the president. I've always been clear with you guys. I don't think I'm going to vote for the guy again. But often it feels like that President Trump is leading the Republicans, even though they are a broken ship, they are a broken weapon, very flawed, that they are what's being held up to fight against this destructive effort to destroy the constitutional order, destroy our freedoms, destroy our norms, destroy what keeps us together and keeps the country okay, that protects people of all beliefs in the majority or the minority. But all of that is being upturned. There is no question now to the Democrats that isn't worth looking upon again and seeing if they can turn it over to advantage their side, no matter the consequences it will do to your freedoms or mine. This is an extremely serious matter, my friends. Extremely serious. And this column by Kevin Williams is just fantastic. I mean, Kevin Williams is probably one of my favorite writers, right up there next to Jonah Goldberg. Love those guys. Kathy Young's also up there on the list. She's a great writer, too. I love these people. But this is super clear. This is what it's all about. And that is why the court packing is so egregious. And it gives me hope because Americans, there's some part of them that recognizes what this is. They may not understand the severity of the poison, but they recognize it's toxic. Ben Sasse, he says that this attack, this bi-court packing, he calls it a suicide bombing of the two branches of government. He says what they're talking about is blowing up the deliberative structure of the United States Senate by abolishing the filibuster and making it possible to turn the Senate into just another House of Representatives where every 2 years, by a 51-49 or 49-51 majority, major portions of American life change. And they're going to do that by packing the Supreme Court. Now, I know the tenor of the podcast just got pretty heavy. And I apologize for that. Sometimes, though, when you really put things down and you look at them clearly, big picture, it is quite shocking what is in front of us as a country and as a society. And there is hope. There is light here. But it will require, if we want to keep our freedoms and we want to stand up for our rights, it will require that we have to stand taller. These are heavy things, and it will require more of us as individual people, as citizens, as leaders, as thinkers, as people in our different professions. I in journalism, but you know, this podcast, but whatever it is that you do. And it will get harder to stand taller for individual freedom, for restraint of law. It will be harder to defend things like the Bill of Rights. It will be harder to defend things like having a right to religion, having a right to your property, to defend yourselves. These things are being eroded. And I don't know how bad it will get. I hope I'm wrong and this is all hyperbole and exaggeration and we'll turn back from the abyss. But I'm not totally certain about that. And as an honest man and someone that really does care about you, my audience, my friends, I'm warning you, this is what's coming our way. It's some heavy stuff, guys. And so you need to be awake. You need to be standing strong with your families. And you need to teach your family and your friends to stand strong for the constitutional norms and the civil rights and everything that made this country so great. And this poll that shows that everyone still mostly is against court packing should give us hope because the game isn't done yet. It isn't over yet. There's still a light for freedom and we cannot allow it to be snuffed out. So for today's last segment, we will be continuing our discussion of hard issues facing the U.S. when it comes to this election, but more importantly, our future after it, the survival of our constitutional order, how we're going to continue to keep together as a society, heavy, big picture stuff. You know, we've talked about the idea about possible another civil war, some kind of conflict like that happening. We've talked about the issue of rigging elections and voter fraud. And are those issues legit or not? Or what else is coming to us that will fundamentally unravel things that we used to consider solid, things that we could really rely upon and we expected to always be there, and that's part of being a normal American. Well, one of these things that's a big issue that we aren't really talking enough about, and we aren't getting a handle on it, and Republicans in particular have been cowards on the issue. They complain a fair amount, but they don't want to do anything about it, and that is the issue of big tech. This last week, I had the cool honor of having another of my articles published with the Post-Millennial. Electronic Arts teams up with the ADL to enforce social justice in gaming, and this is going to be part of this topic of a big tech and the bias that is against free speech and people who are right-wing or heterodox thinkers. But before we get to that, I want to talk a little bit about an interview that's coming up, and then I want to refresh you guys on the bias from big tech. So if everything holds together, we should be doing an interview this week with Alan Bukhari. He is a big tech reporter for Breitbart. He just published this book. It's great. Deleted. Big Tech's Battle to Erase the Trump Movement Steal Election. I just finished reading it today. And Bukhari is a really great reporter. He's broken open big stories like the Google tape. That was the Hands on Deck meeting after 2016 where the people at Google publicly bemoaned and mourned over the Trump election. He's also the one that broke open the Good Censor. That was this incredible document at Google where they talked about how Silicon Valley now has to be about censorship and that the idea of an unfettered free internet was a utopian narrative. He's done stories like on Facebook hate agents, the blacklist on YouTube and Google and elsewhere. I mean, one of the reasons I even still read Breitbart, to be honest, is Bukhari's work. Breitbart has some of the best tech reporting, strangely enough, and he's just amazing. So everything holds together. We should be doing an interview with him this week, and you can find that on social media, YouTube, and the podcast. I'm crossing my fingers on that. I'm really excited to be doing this interview with this guy. Big tech is a very big problem. Essentially, what has happened with big tech, big picture, is that the structure of the web that we all rely on, social media, payment processors, web search, mobile, all of it, is owned by corporations that are very happy to cater to the woke and to use censorship against people who fall outside of a very strict corporate woke vision. And, you know, at first they would just take people down like Alex Jones. I think the first episode of the podcast, we talk about Alex Jones being censored. But then that when I warned at the time with my friend Robert, my producer, we said, this isn't going to just stay there. It isn't going to stop at Alex Jones. They're just going to take the crazies off first so to see if they can do this to get, you know, closer and closer to their ideal vision of an audience. And that's what's happened. And we see more and more people, who, you know, people who are Republicans, people who are conservatives, some people on the left, anti-war folks, get kicked off, censored, shadow banned on social media very routinely. It isn't just the severity that big tech is willing to go. You know, these measures where they will label people as hate speech, haters, racists, they're becoming more brazen about their willingness to go in this direction. But it isn't just that. It isn't just the culture war and attacking people. They're also making it so stories disappear or you are not allowed to talk about legit news. We saw this last year with the impeachment trial right-wing news, when they came out with the name of the whistleblower and then they had their Facebook pages taken down, when people who mentioned the guy involved, and I'm not even sure if I can say it because I don't want to get kicked off all my platforms, and they just took them down. That was it. Well, we just had this in the last week. Again, this is from Reclaim the Net. Twitter hides all search results for the Obamagate hashtag. Twitter suppresses one of the week's top stories. And this is from the article. Twitter is hiding the hashtag search results related to Obamagate. Remember, Obamagate, we just learned more and more about this, that, you know, the Obama administration working with Hillary Clinton, the FBI, did not allow for a clean and peaceful election transition. Instead, they basically cooked up this thing that Trump and his campaign were working with the Russians, and that got pushed by the media for 3 years. Okay, we now know that's for a fact. That's not me guessing. That's not just perusing. We're not shooting the breeze trying to guess here. We know that for a fact. That is what happened, as I showed you in the earlier moment with Pence when he says as much. Well, if you were to go on Twitter and you were to type up the hashtag Obamagate, you would get zero results. You would get none of the results for Obamagate. It would say the term you entered did not bring up any results. This is a major story. This may be the biggest story. If it wasn't COVID this year, that probably would be the biggest story. You're not allowed to talk about it on Twitter. Well, you can talk about it, just no one will see it. You're in that digital ghetto. You can say whatever you want, guys, just, you know, no one's going to see it. It's like shadow banning. You can speak, but no one's going to hear your voice. There is an extreme bias against people who work in news and journalism and social media. If you are a conservative, if you are a libertarian, if you're a heterodox thinker, maybe you're a classical liberal that has concerns about trans kids. You know, Abigail Schreier, who wrote that great book this year, Dr. Deborah So, who wrote on a similar topic about trans kids and other issues that aren't allowed to be talked about. They will make it very hard for your career. Spotify is trying to take control of and censor Joe Rogan because Joe Rogan agreed to $100 million plus deal with them. And the people at the company are trying to get a control of Joe Rogan. And it looks like they've partially succeeded. The world's biggest podcaster. He has a bigger media footprint than many weeks of all the mainstream media, big broadcast news channels combined. And they may be able to pull it off. They've already made it so many of his popular but controversial episodes, including the one with Abigail Schreier just from this summer, July. You can't find it on Spotify. You can only watch on YouTube. We have this excellent example of this bias against conservative journalists and thinkers with my hero, John Stossel. John Stossel, the journalist who was reporter and anchor for ABC for decades and then went over to Fox News and did his own show there, Fox Business. And then he's now a YouTube and journalist for Reason, among other things. I love John Stossel and his mustache. John Stossel is the reason I wanted to become a journalist. He was kind of my first journalism hero. So I have a great, tremendous amount of respect for this man. So the story here is that John, he put up a video on Facebook about the California wildfires. And what he got back on his video was a warning from Facebook. And it said, missing context. Independent fact checkers say this information could mislead people. Now, if you get this kind of error, it's going to hurt your ability for people to see your video. Facebook will take that as part of their algorithm to say people should not see this video because it's not factually true in Facebook's eyes. The one that had labeled the fact check on Stossel's video was a group called Climate Feedback. The fact check, the claim they made why his video was misinformation, was that he had made a claim that forest fires were only caused by poor management and not by climate change. However, Stossel never says that. In the video, he said that the forest fires were caused by global warming, but also poor forestry management and other reasons. Now, Stossel, instead of just taking this lying down, like so many of us, Stossel decided to do what a reporter should do. And he looked into it.
Feel for Mark Zuckerberg.
Do you see a potential problem here?
People from all sides accuse Facebook of favoring the other side's posts.
A pervasive pattern of political bias.
Do you fact check on any ads?
But there's no way Facebook can police everything. The site carries billions of posts. I wish they'd just let the information flow. People will learn to sort truth from lies. But what Facebook did to try to please politicians is let other people censor.
We work with a set of independent fact checkers.
That's how Climate Feedback gets its power. Facebook says I can appeal, but my appeal must go to climate feedback. I tried. I emailed the editor. She didn't respond. But two of three scientists listed as reviewers did agree to interviews. You're smearing me based on something I didn't say.
Yeah, I mean, I've never commented on your article.
That was a shock. He hadn't even seen my video.
If this is implying that we have reviewed the video, then this is clearly wrong. There's something wrong with the system.
He said my video was probably flagged because I interviewed environmentalist Michael Schellenberger. Climate Feedback doesn't like his new book that criticizes environmental alarmism.
My assumption is because Schellenberger pops up in there and his statements have basically been shown to be partially wrong.
This issue has become very political, which is unfortunate.
Zeke Hausfather is another Climate Feedback reviewer. He hadn't seen the video either.
I certainly did not write a Climate Feedback piece reviewing your segment.
So we sent him a link to my video, and he watched it.
Is that a fair label on the video that I did?
I don't necessarily think so. You know, while there's plenty of debates around how much to emphasize forest management versus climate change, your piece clearly discussed that both were at fault here.
After Hausfather and Doerr admitted that Climate Feedback hadn't shown them my video, Climate Feedback's editor finally responded to our emails. She gave us an email address where we could file a complaint. When we did, they wrote us back that now, finally, they have watched the video. But they stand by their smear because the claims don't accurately reflect scientific evidence. Also, both scientists I interviewed emailed me afterward to say they do support Climate Feedback's position. Hausfather writing, after talking to the folks at Climate Feedback, he now thinks my video minimizes the role of climate. Ah, that's what this is about. I interviewed Schellenberger, who argues,
a small change in temperature is not the difference between normalcy and catastrophe.
And Climate Feedback doesn't want people to hear that. It's enraging that Facebook gives these activists the power to silence one side of the debate.
John Stossa, what he does there, looking at what is actually happening, this fact checks, is so invaluable because this happens to people regularly. And they have no way to look into it. They have no way to fight back. And John Stossa, he shows that all the power is with these activist groups. Silicon Valley, the big tech, has sided with the leftist activists. There are very few times that they have allowed people on the right side of the spectrum any room in the fact-checking process. In fact, there are stories of when news organizations that are associated with the right wing had authority to fact-check an article that led to this huge blow-up, which is exactly what happened when it was announced that Facebook had announced a partnership with Check Your Fact, which was a subsidiary of the right-wing website, The Daily Caller. So we know that the fact-checking operation that is being used as justification on Facebook especially, but also on places we're now seeing with Twitter, is completely one-sided. It's completely biased against people who are more inclined to free speech or heterodox views. And there is nothing you can do about it. That is the sad truth of the story. When it comes to big tech and censorship, there is very little recourse people have. You can spend years, thousands upon thousands of dollars, building up a platform on one of these tech giants' companies. And you obey the rules, you do everything that they ask for you, you're good on the site, and then one day, they snuff your page out, and that's it. Zero recourse. There's nothing you can do. Facebook says your article is misinformation. They cut you off right there and then, and that's it. You can appeal, in quotes, but you can't really appeal. Okay? You think on Wikipedia it says, edit this page. Anyone can go there and edit. But in truth, you can't, because behind that is a brick wall. And that's determined by consensus of the editors, who are mostly big-time left-wing activists. So big tech is firmly against conservative thinkers, right-wingers, heterodox people, which is more and more including people who are just classical liberals. And this attack on right-wingers and free speech people is only going to get worse. I just did this article for the Postmillennial, and it took several months of research to do it. And the article is called Electronic Arts Teams Up with the ADL to Enforce Social Justice in Gaming. And I'm going to do a separate episode on this project alone that's coming up. That'll also be on YouTube because I want to get into the nitty-gritty on this. But basically, the story is how we first saw in Germany that there was the German government partnering with Electronic Arts primarily and some other game companies for these social justice programs. And they would say that we have to push these programs. One of them is Good Gaming, Well Played Democracy. The other one is Keinen Pixel den Faschisten, or No Pixels for Fascists. And these organizations were working with the German government, Electronic Arts, in an effort to make sure that people who are gamers do not get radicalized to becoming violent or members of the far right. This is a thing. We have to save the children, and so we can save them from becoming far right. We have to take over gaming and all that is around it. Now, I am not the one that initially uncovered where the story starts with Germany. A friend of mine that goes by the handle Lunar Archivist on Reddit and Twitter, this is the person that got it going, and this person helped me with translating the articles and archiving them, and they really deserve more credit for this project than honestly I do, at least for the German section of it. And the organizations that are behind these two groups, Good Gaming and No Pixels for Fascists, are just bonkers left-wing organizations. Behind Good Gaming is this group called the Amadeo Antonio Foundation, which was started by a former Stasi informant named Annette Cahen. And their organization got in trouble last year for literally sending a brochure to German schools and their parents that said you could recognize a girl, her family being far right, if the girl likes to wear dresses and she does chores at home. Both of these organizations are obsessed with stopping the far right. But the way they define the far right is basically anyone that's right wing. And if you go into their documents, they make this explicitly clear. And in fact, the gateway drugs that you do this, you are going to become far right, are insane. They're so innocuous. It's downright silly. It's hilarious, actually, when you read all these documents. And I only include some of them in the article. But evidence that they would frequently use were things like, do you like YouTubers? Do you watch PewDiePie? You too may be a member of the far right. Do you enjoy a historical video game? Do you think historical video games marketed as historical video games should maybe try to be historical? Well, you might be a neo-Nazi. Do you dislike the game The Sims? No joke, there is a whole essay on this. Do you dislike the game The Sims? Well, perhaps you're a little too comfortable with the white hoods. Hey, did you notice that women often enjoy playing mobile games like Candy Crush, which, by the way, the sales overwhelmingly show? Well, you too might be a member of the far right. And I'm joking, but I'm not, because that's what they write over and over. They have so many sections of the blogs, like in these long essays, these huge diatribes and interviews where they say stuff like this. And they say it completely seriously. And you realize when you read their works, when you read their words, you understand that they may care about the far right, but what they really care about is the right wing in general. And that what bothers them is that right-wingers enjoy space in gaming and online social media at all. That is what this push from Germany is about. I mean, No Pixels for Fascists, which is probably the more extreme of the two groups, they say their goal is to be a collective of websites, media figures, news orgs, research groups, and game studios. And they want to educate organizations of people about how gamers get radicalized becoming far right and how the right wing use internet spaces. And they don't say how the far right use internet spaces. They say the right wing. And according to their documents, this includes teaching organizations and individuals how to identify a right wing mindset just by looking at their social media profile. No Pixels. They have such a strong social justice, progressive bias, a real hatred for typical gamers. One of the heads of the project No Pixels, a gal by the name of Bradenberg, wrote that gamers, even the term gamers, is so actively anti-diversity, it's so right-wing, that the term has to be obliterated. to her, and this is from her one of her essays, she writes that gamers are just really toxic nerd masculinity sitting in their tree houses. I say this because you need to understand the disdain they have for those who you think would be the audience of gaming, the gamers, which will include some people who are right-wing. And they say that even scientific research itself, scientists, should never do research that could ever be used for the benefit of people who are right-wingers. I mean, they go that far. They said that scientific work must always take a backseat to fulfill their ideological and political needs. Now, this part of the story, me and my source, we worked through it, and we basically had most of this down by the end of May. And the question we had left at that point was, and we researched this through the summer, was, does this stop in Germany? Is the interest at saying that right-wingers shouldn't be allowed in gaming and game spaces online and social media? It's not part of the article, but in No Pixels has this thing where they advocate transnational legislation to make sure people are deplatformed. They want that to be part of law in the EU. We want to know, does this push stop in Germany, or does it go along with what we see with the appetite of big tech in the West, which is for censorship? And the answer to that question was yes. We found out in September that the Anti-Defamation League, an organization strongly against free speech and strongly against gamers, they've tried to take down Steam with a big hit, also against PewDiePie for some reason, last year. They were partnering in a project that seems like the English mirror of the No Pixels one with groups like Facebook, Google, Microsoft, Electronic Arts, Ubisoft, Epic Games, and others for the organization called Games for Change. And the project's name was Raising Good Gamers. And Raising Good Gamers, it sounds innocent at first. They say it's their goal is to create a more diverse, inclusive, and positive online environment for the kiddies, for the youth. Except, not dissimilar to the German project, if you actually read any of the stuff they're putting out or listen to their talks and their YouTube conference sessions, you find out that, no, this is very similar to New Pixels project. It carries the same premises of gaming and how gaming needs to change. To quote the white paper they released on the announcement of this project, gaming culture to them is, quote, exclusionary and discriminatory, reproducing and encoding systems of bias and inequity that pervade society as a whole, unquote. Wait, gaming culture is exclusionary, discriminatory, and re-encodes systems of bias? It's video games, okay? It's not the education system. It's not the patriarchy. It's video games. But you read the document and you find out they want to turn video games into, quote, become an important and potentially powerful tool for achieving broader goals of social justice, unquote. And there it is. The same appetite in Germany to deplatform and hurt gaming and free speech in gaming and right-wingers online, there is seemingly the same appetite here in the rest of the West. This should not have to be said at this point, but big tech is not your friend. No matter how much those game companies like EA may say that they appreciate your support, they appreciate your money, but they hate they get it from you. As was noted by Brian J. Blake in his book about Palmer Luckey and Facebook, he was one of my first big interviews. I love Brian J. Harris. He's amazing. He talked about that Mark Zuckerberg, for the vision for Oculus, didn't want anyone to just access it. He had a very specific vision of a very specific kind of audience that would use this. Big tech is not your friend, okay? They want your money, for sure, but they don't want you. Big tech is not for the advancement of freedom and free speech. Before 2016, there was a feeling in Silicon Valley that they were going to change the world to connect people. They wouldn't be evil. But that's gone. It died over the course of the years by politicians and by activists. By the 2016 election, it made people think that, yeah, you know what? Big tech does have the power and we should use it. And so they want to, and they will. And they have given seats and more power to social justice activists, and they have sequestered and cut off the employees and influencers of these companies who are heterodox and conservative. This is just the truth of the matter, gang. Big tech is not your friend. That is the lesson I hope that we all learn. We created this machine. We gave them few restraints. We gave them all our information and put all our trust into them. And we should have realized that if we created a power with few checks, that perhaps one day it might outgrow us. That its priorities wouldn't be our own. That perhaps if people who didn't have the best intentions in mind for the rest of us were able to somehow gain control. And that, my friends, is the story of big tech, where we are at. Now, I believe in God's plan. I believe in the goodness of mankind and our ability to overcome terrible obstacles. But this is one of those. And I have hope that we'll find a way through this. I don't know how that happens. I think maybe in time other platforms show up or people wise up or our politicians get a backbone. I don't know what it is. But freedom is something special and it's worth defending and fighting for. And it won't just exist without work on our part. And so we need to do what we can here at the Happy Warrior Podcast, in your homes and throughout the country, to keep the flame of freedom alive. And that's what we do here at the Happy Warrior Podcast, educating and enlightening so you can better see the obstacles that are in front of our path. I love all the cool things that come from big tech. I'm grateful for it, but I don't want to have to lose my freedom to get the cool tech goodies. And I don't think you want it either. And I'm hoping that in the long run, that will be the decision by America and by the rest of mankind. Well, this has been the Happy Warrior Podcast. I appreciate you guys listening and checking the podcast out. Please be sure to share it with your friends and family on social media. Rate and review. Tell everybody about this. Until next time, please look out for that interview with Alan Bukhari and the deep dive on the post-millennial article. So until next time, good night, America.
Thank you for listening. The Happy Warrior Podcast, hosted by Peter Vaughn Pischke, produced by Robert Mayling, a production of the Sioux Empire Podcast Network. Learn more at happy-warrior.net.
A production of the SiouxEmpire.com.